What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Michael Barenbaum, discussing the new digital release of the Oscar-winning documentary, The Last Day, and his role as Hollywood's historical expert on the Holocaust. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Like so many of you, I've closely followed the bad news that exploded from Israel this week. As always in the Middle East, the situation is far more complicated than it appears to be at first glance. Our hearts go out to the Israelis who have died in Palestinian and Israeli-Arab attacks, to their families, and to the Jewish nation that has seen its life shockingly and frighteningly disturbed by air raid sirens, neighborhood explosions, and trips to the bomb shelter. Israelis now fully expect a war in Gaza, the first since 2014, and it may already have started. Tragically, there will be further casualties to come. And we are deeply saddened that many innocent Palestinians will die too, led into disaster by leaders who value their lives only when Israelis take them. I am also deeply disturbed that Israeli Arabs are not the only ones gathering in mobs to attack Jewish neighbors, and that Jewish Israelis have also formed mobs and attacked Arab neighbors. Lynching is horribly, morally wrong on either side, and it must be stopped immediately. But what are the issues here, and why has all this happened right now? There are four critical areas involved. First, the Temple Mount and the Sheikh Jarrah issue. Second, the Hamas attacks from Gaza. Third, the mobs and Israeli Arab and Jewish rioting in Lod, Akko, Bat Yam, and elsewhere. And fourth, the peripheral events, like the West Bank violence and rockets coming from Lebanon. First, the Temple Mount. The initial violence was, frankly, predictable. After 14 months of COVID-19 lockdowns, Israelis and Palestinians have been experiencing a return to public life eagerly and energetically. The lid that coronavirus placed on human movement and association ironically contributed to a mandatory pacification in the area. When that lid lifted, the seething pot underneath was bound to boil over. When you compound that situation with the Ramadan fasting month and huge crowds of Palestinian Arabs entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque while hungry and prime for action, you're going to get some trouble. I've been at the entrance to the noble sanctuary of the Temple Mount during Ramadan on an ordinary Friday, long before COVID-19. The tensions then between the huge numbers of Arab-Palestinian worshippers and the Israeli police simply maintaining order and keeping Jews, like me, from mixing into that mob, were obvious. A few stones were tossed even on that relatively calm day. Hungry, cranky Arab men in the immediate aftermath of coronavirus lockdowns, who feel oppressed by an Israeli government that officially does not represent their needs, Jerusalem Arabs can't even vote for Knesset, are going to be particularly dangerous in a large group. Why, some might even storm a government building, for example, if given the opportunity to do so. These men chose to resort to throwing stones at Jews, an old habit. Add in the Jerusalem Day festivities, which happened to fall around the same day and celebrate the Israeli capture of the Holy City in the Six-Day War, you have a recipe for disaster, or at least nasty, violent rioting, with Palestinian and Jewish casualties, mostly Palestinian when police and troops put down the riots. As for the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood issue, well, that has just about nothing to do with all of this. The four-year-old legal case has gone to the very liberal Israeli Supreme Court, and it involves, I kid you not, four houses that have been contested in courts for, 50 years, based on a land purchase going back to the 19th century. That anyone even knows the name of this neighborhood is actually astonishing, but that's how it goes in Jerusalem. The smallest, most insignificant place, rock, or tree can become a focal point for channeled aggression. This Temple Mount violence is about the overall frustration of living life as an East Jerusalem Palestinian. It's not about Sheikh Jarrah. Now, second, the Hamas aggression. There is one central point that every news story and most commentaries miss about the explosions at the end of last week. There were supposed to be Palestinian elections for a representative assembly on May 22, 2021, next week. These would have been the first elections held in the West Bank since the elections of Mahmoud Abbas as president and of the entire Palestinian Legislative Council way back in January 2006. January 2006, 15 years ago. There have not been any elections either for president or the Palestinian legislature since then. Palestinians were understandably excited about the elections and looking forward to them. But then, on April 29th, Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority, indefinitely postponed those Palestinian elections. There's much speculation as to why he did this, but most people believe he thought that his party's great rival and enemy, the Islamist terrorists of Hamas, would win that election. Rather than risk losing the election for representatives in the West Bank and therefore losing power, Abbas did what he has done before. He postponed the elections indefinitely, perhaps forever. Israel has too many elections for Knesset, its National Assembly, four in just the past 2 years. But the Palestinians, they have no elections. When trouble broke out from the Temple Mount, men and youths throwing stones at police and everybody else, Hamas leaders saw it as the perfect time to claim the leadership role among Palestinians they have always asserted. If Hamas can't win elections in East Jerusalem and the West Bank at this non-existent ballot box, well, they can win by proving they're able to successfully attack Israel. The Hamas plan is to cause shock and damage to Israel's psyche, kill some innocent Israelis, have Israel's defense forces create new Palestinian martyrs in the expected huge IDF response, and possibly kill a few Israeli soldiers, and then have the international community step in and stop the Israelis before the punishment becomes intolerable. To date, Hamas and other Palestinian terrorist groups, some to the farther right of Hamas, have fired 1,700 rockets at Israel from Gaza, some of which have reached Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Seven Israelis have been killed as I record this, over 200 wounded in this unprovoked violent war made on civilians. Undoubtedly the numbers will get worse. It must be said that firing unaimed rockets at civilian populations is quite specifically a war crime. It must also be noted that many of the rockets Hamas fires land on Gaza itself. They are unaimed, crude, and inaccurate. Perhaps 20% of them fall on Gaza and kill Palestinians. Israel's Iron Dome defensive missile system has intercepted many, but not all, the rockets. It's successful at stopping perhaps 85% of the rockets it tries to stop. Asymmetrical warfare is always a challenge. I've seen the rockets Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad fire. They are inexpensive, unguided metal tubes filled with explosives, and they cost in the hundreds of dollars at most. Each time Iron Dome fires, every one of the multiple missiles it uses costs about $50,000. The missile batteries themselves cost about $100 million. That is, to shoot down a $100 rocket aimed at a non-military target, Israel spends hundreds of thousands of dollars protecting its civilians. Hamas spends $100 trying to get Israel to kill its civilians. There's a difference this time, however. The longer-range rockets being used now by Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Gaza have come from Iran, and they can reach Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. They were smuggled in, possibly with the acceptance or, well, who knows, bribery of Egypt, during the quiet periods during the pandemic. Sderot, Ashkelon, Ashdod, and Beersheba are used to having rockets strike their region repeatedly. That's not so true in Tel Aviv or Rishon LeZion or Jerusalem. Israel's military response to Hamas's terror war has been in the news more than Hamas's incitement, of course, as we have come to expect. In a broad series of airstrikes, plus some artillery shelling, Israel has destroyed much of Hamas's military capability, blowing up the apartment buildings and homes the terrorist group uses to direct attacks, both missile and drone attacks, on Israeli civilians. Israeli strikes have killed a series of high-ranking Hamas operatives and many of their soldiers as well. There will be a land war in Gaza again, the fifth since Hamas brutally expelled the Palestinian Authority at Fatah in a coup in 2007. There were Israeli wars in Gaza of various intensity then and in 2008 and 12 and 14. Frankly, most informed observers believed there would be another Gaza war long before this, 2021, 7 years. No one in their right mind wants war. But by the same token, no sovereign nation can allow its citizens to be attacked with rockets indiscriminately without stopping the perpetrators from committing these war crimes. Now, mob violence, number three. Again, this is unconscionable, and it threatens the occasionally frayed but durable tolerance that has existed between Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews. There is no question that Israeli Arabs, who vote and have elected representatives in Knesset, a lot more than can be said of their brothers and sisters in the Palestinian Authority, Gaza, Jordan, Egypt, and, well, anywhere else around the Middle East. Still, Israeli Arabs are second-class citizens in Israel. Their schools are funded at lower levels. The hospitals and roads in their areas are of lesser quality. They routinely experience discrimination of a variety of kinds, some of it humiliating and offensive. Still, generally, they are in better economic shape than Palestinians living anywhere else in the world, and they have more political, religious, and personal freedom than they would have in the West Bank or Gaza or Jordan or Lebanon or Syria or Egypt or the Gulf states. That uneasy balance means that most of Israel's nearly 2 million Arab residents, the vast majority of whom consider themselves Palestinians, are not so unhappy as to engage in violence or terrorism. In fact, just before the outbreak of this latest round of violence, Israel was on the verge of forming its first government in history that would have included one of the Arab parties and its leader, Mansour Abbas. The current violence makes that academic now, I'm afraid. There have been incidents in the past when Israeli Arabs participated in intifada-style violence, and these have been few and far between, thank God. The violence this past week in Lod, Akko, Bat Yam, and elsewhere was shocking. Arab gangs attacked Jews. Jewish gangs attacked Arabs. Autos and buildings were burned. People were beaten and killed. Responsible religious and political leaders, Muslim and Jewish, Arab and Israeli, condemned the violence and urged peace and a return to cooperation. The central city of Lod near Ben-Gurion Airport saw a synagogue burned down by an Arab mob and was basically under martial law for a while this past week. This is the most distressing aspect of the situation and the only actually newish part of it. The hope is that this is a temporary problem, born in part out of the post-coronavirus reaction, but we will watch it carefully. Israel's a nation of about 7 million Jews and almost 2 million Arabs. It can ill afford the kind of fraternal violence this past week provided. Finally, there are the troubling peripheral problems. A few rockets were fired toward Israel last week from Lebanon, maybe by Hezbollah, another Iranian proxy terror group that has troubled Israel greatly over recent years. However, the likelihood right now is that this was done by Palestinian factions in southern Lebanon, who are powerless, not Hezbollah, which actively despises the Palestinians, by the way. The rockets missed, went into the Mediterranean, and the Lebanese government supposedly arrested the people responsible. Of greater concern, at least now, is the situation in the West Bank, where conditions are always on the edge of trouble. There have been scattered reports of flare-ups in the West Bank, where Fatah and the Palestinian Authority remain in control. One Palestinian was killed in an Israeli raid, and rioting has taken place. But as of the time we're doing this show, the West Bank is fairly quiet. We will see what transpires when Israel moves into full war in Gaza. The conclusion of this story is easy to see. It is not a happy ending, exactly. We are likely to have another full Gaza war, with Gaza mostly destroyed again, people dying on both sides, mostly Palestinians. Israel will, quote-unquote, win the military aspect of the war and stop the rockets from falling on its people. Hamas will be branded among Palestinians as the brave defender of Palestinian rights and hallucinatory dreams. And the even more violent Palestinian Islamic Jihad will lose a bit of power in Gaza. Most of the international community will rail against Israel for defending her own people and try to force a ceasefire as soon as possible, whether Hamas stops shooting rockets or not. Anti-Semites, right and left, will accuse Israel of war crimes and attacking civilians, and vicious people may even choose to physically try to attack Jews around the world to compensate for their own cowardice. There will be demonstrations protesting for and against Israel. And after it's all over, what then? Tragically, people will die. The Palestinians in Gaza will be much worse off. The Israeli Arabs will have lost a real chance to advance their people's second-class citizenship to something better. Israel will have lost some of its post-COVID complacency. For better and worse, nothing much will improve or really change. Unless, somewhere in all of this, there is finally some recognition that continuing forever down this road simply means never getting off the path of permanent low-grade hostility mixed with intermittent bursts of warfare. Hatikva means the hope. We Jews held onto it for close to 2,000 years until we had our own country again. We must continue to hope for a better, more humane approach to emerge, and for God to help everyone see that peace is more attractive than eternal tension and hatred. To play us in this morning, here's that classic Israeli song of peace, Shir LeShalom, a song of peace written back in 1969, covered by Israeli star Ninette Taib in 2015. Ninette singing Shir LeShalom, a song of peace. May it return soon to Israel. When we come back on Too Jewish in a moment, our guest, Professor and Rabbi Michael Barenbaum, explains why the new digital release of the Oscar-winning documentary The Last Day about the Hungarian Holocaust is so important right now. Find out when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town. amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in Northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Email me to rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services on Facebook Live at 6:30 p.m., Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page again is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access them by emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Our wonderful religious school, coming into the home stretch now, is available in blended formats as well, some students live and some coming on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to Shavuot services and study sessions tonight at 7:30 p.m. or tomorrow morning for Yisker services at 10 a.m., come to our great religious school, Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, High School program, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and of course, all of our services, live or on Facebook Live, and our classes, live or on Zoom. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing synagogue community in all of Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Michael Berenbaum is one of the most distinguished American scholars of the Holocaust. Professor, rabbi, writer, filmmaker, he's here to discuss the re-release of an Oscar-winning film on which he was the historical consultant that deals specifically with the Holocaust among Hungarian Jews. You may remember it, and I hope you do. It's called The Last Day. Good morning, and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Happy to be with you.
So tell us a little bit about how The Last Day originally started as a documentary and your involvement with it.
Well, let's begin with the historical event that's based on. The deportation of Hungarian Jews were free, relatively free, until 1944. And the entire Holocaust, which took place in 12 years in Germany and in 6 years in Poland, took place within a very brief moment in Hungary. The Germans invaded on March 19th. They ghettoized the Jews between April and May, and then they deported 437,402 Jews on 54 trains between the 15th of May and the 8th of July. That is 2,975 Jews per train, 2.75 trains a day. And if you've ever been to Birkenau, you see the track that goes right
into the middle of the camp.
That was a track built for the deportation of Hungarian Jews. It did not exist till the winter and early spring of 1944, meaning that the Germans built the infrastructure so that three trains could arrive in one day.
And so much of this was under...
They could be unloaded and their Jews could be selected, deported, selected, gassed, murdered, and the remaining Jews put to work. So we decided that if we were going to make a documentary that we wanted to do on the Holocaust, it would be wise to center on this event, which took place with such intensity, with such rapidity, with such cruelty. And I want to remind your listeners that it took place after the Germans understood that the war was going to be lost. So it was Hitler's last stand to get the Jews before he lost the war. And we felt that that was a unique opportunity to tell a large story that also had a very small story. We had a series of Hungarian survivors available to us, and some of them were extraordinarily articulate and people who could speak deeply and profoundly of their experience. And then we did two things with them, which was quite important, which is we took them back to Auschwitz, and we took them back to their hometowns. So they returned, as it were, to the place from which they came, and then they gave voice to their entire experience. This was a documentary of the Shoah Foundation. At that point, I was the president of the Shoah Foundation, and they wanted, obviously, my input. Even if they didn't want it, they probably had no choice. I was president of the organization. And consequently, I was involved in it. And my advice to the filmmaker...
That's Jim Moll,
James
right?
Moll. Yeah. My advice to him was the advice I've given to every filmmaker who's worked on the Holocaust, which is don't add drama. Let the drama only speak forth.
I'm going to interrupt so that we can stick to our time frame, but I want to note that this has just been re-released in a remastered digital version, and we'll talk about why it's important that The Last Day comes out again now in 2021 when we come back in a moment with Dr. Michael Barenbaum, our guest this morning on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us to TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, TooJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, Tom, a couple weeks ago we talked about a man who was leaving, I think it was Kabul, Afghanistan. It was kind of the last Jew in Kabul who had preserved the synagogue more or less by himself while his family remained in Israel. Led me to think about all of the amazing Jewish communities of the world that have now essentially been emptied of Jews as those communities migrated primarily to Israel, but also to other countries, United States, France, Canada, and so on. It's wonderful that Jews don't have to remain in exile, but something is definitely lost from these extraordinary and unique Jewish communities when they aren't active anymore.
Right. Well, clearly part of that something that's lost is the continuity of Jewish presence and Jewish activity and use by Jews rather than by tourists of Jewish heritage sites, whether it's a cemetery or a synagogue or an old Jewish school, whatever it is. You see this a lot in Morocco, and Morocco still does have some Jewish communities.
Right.
But in many places, all that's there is a Jewish cemetery or an old Jewish school or an old Jewish synagogue.
Right.
That is, in some cases, locked.
Yeah, like Fez, as opposed to there's some active Jewish life in Casablanca still, or in
Marrakesh.
Marrakesh, of course. But still just a
tiny fragment of what it was.
But I'm thinking like Meknes, for example.
Yeah, Meknes, has, where there's nobody.
A lot of sites. So in the case of Morocco, the government is, oh, first of all, the royal family had always been very protective of the Jews. So the king is disposed towards being as nice as possible to visiting Jews, remaining Jews. They actually, if they figure out that a tour group is largely Jewish or visiting largely Jewish sites, they actually assign plainclothes security people to help keep those Jewish tourists safe. They don't make this explicit, but after several visits, you figure it out pretty quickly. And the government of Morocco is spending a lot of money restoring, or in some cases, just preserving these ancient Jewish sites. I don't know if they really hope that Jews will return, but at least in the case of Morocco, because of government policies and because of tourist interests and things like that, the Jewish presence and the Jewish past is still palpable, even in places where there are either no Jews or a handful of Jews, but not enough to make a minion. That's also true in Egypt. Very recently, the government decided to start spending a lot of money restoring Jewish heritage sites like the Grand Synagogue of Alexandria. And Egypt has very few Jews left. I just read today about the passing of a guy in his early 90s who was one of the last Egyptian Jews to keep that tradition and that heritage alive. The same is true essentially in Syria and Yemen. I mean, the Jewish populations are down to like single digits. So to get to your point, about what happens when a Jewish community disappears, I think part of the answer is it depends on government policy towards the places that memorialize Jewish history. I do think it's a loss to the world that places where you could once go and join a minyan or be together with a Jewish community and really sense the vastness of Klal Yisrael, it's a loss. It's a diminution somehow of the Jewish presence in the world, even if all the Jews who leave go to Israel.
Right, right. It's ironic. I mean, there's a flavor still in some of the synagogues in Israel that what it must have been like in Aleppo or Tehran or wherever the particular community comes from, but it's still not quite the same. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A guy goes to the doctor, lamenting that he's old and is forgetting things. Yesterday, I even forgot where I lived, doctor. I got lost going home. The day before, I came home from shul and forgot I even went. And the day before, I went to play golf and forgot where I was going. Oi, doctor, the guy cries, what should I do? Pay me now, says the doctor. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the second portion of the book of Numbers, Naso, which includes a remarkable blessing. The Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing, is really three distinct brachot, three separate prayers, with which the ancient priests are commanded to bless the people. From its inception, this three-part blessing has had exceptional importance. As the Torah quotes God saying, with this blessing you will place my name on the people of Israel. Samu et Shemi al Bnei Yisrael. That is, this very blessing conveys God's presence among us and offers divine protection. The blessing was given by the Kohanim, the highest class of priests, those entrusted with the service of the tabernacle and temple. We still use it at every joyous life cycle event. It remains powerful. The text is, may God bless you and guard you. May the light of God's presence shine on you and be gracious to you. May God's presence turn to you and grant you peace. The Birkat Kohanim asks God to supply our most important needs. The majority of the interpretations of this portion see the first blessing requesting physical safety and health, the second asking for material needs to be satisfied, and the third blessing seeks spiritual comfort and confidence. Without any one of these blessings, our lives become a challenge. We certainly learned that last year during the pandemic. With all three, we are assured of true quality of life. You know, after thousands of years, those three elements, safety, grace, and peace, remain central to our lives and a true gift from God. May you be blessed with each of these, with all of these, this week and always. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Michael Barenbaum, discusses the new digital release of the Oscar-winning documentary, The Last Day, and his role as Hollywood's historical expert on the Holocaust. All that when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
My friends, we covered the news from Israel extensively at the start of To Jewish today, so I just have a brief story about the latest Pew study on the American Jewish community, also released this last week. Pew estimates the Jewish population in the U.S. at 7.5 million, about 2.3% of the national population, a little more than we thought, perhaps. The survey of over 4,000 Jewish Americans was conducted between November 2019 and June 2020. It reflected skepticism among U.S. Jews regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Only one-third of Jews say the Israeli government is sincere in seeking peace, but just 12% say Palestinian leaders are sincere in seeking peace. Compared with Americans overall, Jewish Americans on average are older, have higher levels of education and income, and are more geographically concentrated in the Northeast. Not us, we're in the Southwest, but... Even as the Jewish population is doing generally well, concerns about anti-Semitism rose in this study amid the deadly attacks in 2018 and 2019 on the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the Chabad of Poway Synagogue in California, and the Kosher grocery store in Jersey City, New Jersey. Three-quarters of Jewish Americans say there is more anti-Semitism in the U.S. than 5 years ago. 53% say they feel less safe. Jews who wear yarmulkes in public are particularly likely to feel less safe. In other findings of Pew, Jews are notably less religious than American adults as a whole. 21% of American Jews say religion is very important in their lives, compared with 41% of U.S. adults overall. A majority of U.S. adults say they believe in God as described in the Bible, just 26% of Jews do, and 12% of Jewish Americans say they attend religious services at least weekly, versus 27% of the general public. Orthodox Jews are unique. They are among the most religious groups in U.S. society in terms of the share, 86% who say religion's important in their lives, compared with 78% of black Protestants and 76% of white evangelicals. According to Pew, 9% of U.S. Jews describe themselves as Orthodox, just 9%. Far more belong to the two long dominant branches of American Judaism. 37% identify as Reform, 17% as conservative. More than 1 in 4 don't identify with any branch of Judaism, yet consider themselves Jewish ethnically, culturally, or by family background. Interfaith marriage is now commonplace. 42% of married Jewish adults said they have a non-Jewish spouse. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi, Professor, PhD Michael Barenbaum, one of the leading scholars of the Holocaust in America. He's here to speak about the re-release of The Last Day in a digital version, the extraordinary story of the Hungarian Holocaust from the story of several extraordinary survivors, including a prominent U.S. congressman. Tell us, from your perspective, why it's important that The Last Day be re-released now.
I'll speak biblically. A new generation has arisen which did not know the original.
Vayakom melech hadash al Mitzrayim asher liyadat Mitzrayim, yeah.
Et Yosef. But that films without re-release have a little bit of a short shelf life, and this is what we would call, in one sense, an evergreen, which is that every generation can learn from what the film has to say, and every generation should hear its survivors tell and narrate their story. We have, among other people, Tom Lantos of blessed memory, who was a U.S. congressman.
Yeah, amazing guy, actually.
A prominent human rights activist, and he was the only survivor ever to have served in Congress. And the other thing that we should say, which is a sad commentary on our world, is that the Holocaust has not lost relevance in the last 20 years. In fact, it's as relevant today, if not more relevant today, than it was then. But that's a sad commentary on our world. I'm one of the very few people who would dream of living in a world in which what I know and what I've learned becomes irrelevant, because we've learned lessons of the Shoah and we don't have to relearn them again. But that's not our world, and that's not the world we've bequeathed to our children.
In creating The Last Days and in making this documentary, what was the most surprising experience you had? What did you learn that you didn't already know?
I guess the most surprising experience that I found was that you could almost pick up one story from the other. In other words, there was a seamlessness to it, even though there were different individuals who were telling their stories. They all lived through the same thing at the same time. And interestingly enough, they all were approximately the same age. There was probably a 5 or 6 year difference between the oldest and the youngest, and they had I guess we could put it this way: it was all of one cloth, despite differences of experience. Some came from pious families, some came from non-observant families. Tom Lantos, in particular, lived in assimilated Budapest. The others were
from smaller towns.
From the smaller towns, but they all had one story to tell. And the other thing that was intriguing was how much each of them had something that was still unfulfilled, some piece of information that they desperately needed to know. For Alice Lacahana of blessed memory, it was what happened to her sister Edith. For Renee Firestone, it's what type of experiments were done on her sister, and what did that do? She, in fact, met with the doctor who was an assistant to Mengele, was a little bit intriguing, because he was not someone who renounced what they had done in the aftermath of the Shoah, and consequently, I don't want to say that he'd done tshuva, but he was not quite as cruel, quite as bad as the rest of them, and consequently, his experience also, which was narrated in the film, and we had a meeting between him and the survivor to try to go over the documentation that emerged, that becomes a tension point in the film, because the question is, how do you greet and meet and converse with a man who had done such things at that time, and who seems like an ordinary elderly gentleman at this time? I always find that intriguing and perplexing. It gives rise to the notion that these people could live in that world and then could transition to our world almost without interruption. And they were ordinary men who, and I'm using men because the perpetrator we interviewed was a man.
Was a man, of course.
Extraordinary evil.
Right.
But then led normal, ordinary lives. I would even say undistinguished lives in the aftermath. tells us about the humanity of the killers, which should scare us as fellow human beings, because it means that other human beings are, they're not monsters. Other human beings are fully capable of behaving like this, and yet what they did was extraordinarily monstrous.
When Eichmann gets to Budapest, when he arrives in Hungary, he demonstrates, obviously, great efficiency. The Germans, known for their efficiency. The Hungarian Jews, did they think they were going to survive the war at that point in 1944?
They believed that they were going to survive uninterrupted, you know, relatively speaking, uninjured until the German invasion. And then all of a sudden, they understood that Hungary was not going to be an exception, because Hungary had deported non-citizens to be killed in Kamenets Podolsk. If you think of the classic memoir by Elie Wiesel, he speaks of Moshe the Beadle, and Moshe the Beadle leaves and sees the mass murder, comes back to Szeged. That mass murder is a real mass murder. It happened. It happened in Kamenets Podolsk. And Moshe the Beadle, Moshe the Shamus, was essentially one of the survivors of it, who escaped. And why did he come back? He came back to tell the story. So the debate historically is how much Hungarian Jews knew and how much they, quotation marks, should have known, because they were hearing rumors throughout as to what was happening. There were escapees coming in from Poland. Stories were being told, and yet even Elie Wiesel in Night says, Auschwitz, we had never heard the name. So a great historian of blessed memory, Walter McCurr, called a book called The Terrible Secret, The Suppression of Information Regarding Hitler's Final Solution. And what he showed is that everybody suppressed information, including the victims for whom such information was vital to give them a final possibility of making some sort of choice as to their fate. So if you know what the end result is going to be, then you might have a broader choice of your fate. You might still die. You might still be killed.
Of course.
But at least you can make a
some effort to make a choice
of some sort. You know, there was the case in Israel of the question of Rezo Kastner. Israel Kastner, who had a rescue train that brought Jews out, and whether he should have told the community what he knew or may have known. And the other half is what they would have done with such information. And I'm of the opinion that people are entitled to the information, and then they can make whatever choices they have, including going into despair and being unable to function at that point.
Sure.
And panic. And
all, panic, all of the normal human responses,
yeah,
to
but panic
horrible
may,
things.
Panic may have been a legitimate response. I mean, if they're coming to annihilate you, your wife, and your children, you know, panic is a reasonable response. I don't know how else you respond, but panic is certainly one of the
possibilities.
This is not the only film you've worked on that won an Academy Award. There aren't too many people working in Holocaust studies who can make that claim. Tell us a little bit about the experience.
You have to understand something, and this is not a statement of modesty, which is that people who really want to do a historically professional job will then turn to me. And I joke that I'm sort of occasionally in Hollywood the Rav HaBachshir, the rabbi who says, kosher,
yeah,
pray.
Yeah.
You can do this, you can't do this, because the issue in working on the Holocaust is how much can you tell, what images can you use, how much can you, quotation marks, fictionalize, and how accurate can you be? And clearly, those are judgment calls that have been made. And some people seek my advice on judgment calls, and I try to give them my best advice. I'll also tell you, and in relation to the Holocaust, it's an unexpectedly, what we can say, a humorous story about my involvement with one film, but I'll leave the name of the film out.
Okay.
When I married, my wife came to the marriage with a handyman, meaning she had somebody who had, she had been living alone and she was single. She had somebody who repaired things. And about 3 months into the marriage, the handyman turned to her and said, "Do me a favor, call me before your husband starts to fix things." And I was crestfallen, destroyed my imagery. I'm trying to protect my wonderful wife and handle the manly things around. "Oh, just call me before." Well, I was involved in a film in which we had to do an awful lot of work. They had Polish Jews who, for example, had Jewish stars on them, yellow stars on them. The problem is that Jews in the ghettos of Poland did not have yellow stars, especially in Warsaw.
Yep.
They had patches on their arms.
Right. Right.
They also had them, these people marked with a yellow star before Germany had invaded, when obviously the only time they were marked was after Germany was invaded. So I told them the story and I said, "Do me a favor, next time call me before you make the film." Because to re-digitalize it and remove all of that electronically cost a lot of money and a lot of time, but they need to do it, otherwise it appears that they don't know.
Anachronistic, it's not authentic.
If you lose your credibility, you lose your audience.
Right.
And consequently, that was my joke of the handyman.
I want to thank Rabbi Michael Barenbaum, who's the mashgiach of the Hollywood films on the Shoah, and television series, too, I should note. Michael, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Where can people go to find out more about you as well?
Well, they can go to my website, barenbaumgroup.com, or they can look up, do what everybody else does in the world, which is just Google.
Just Google me. That's it.
Go to Rabbi Google, as we say. Thanks so much. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be ADL Regional Director Tammy Gillies, discussing the new ADL report on anti-Semitism. Our playout this morning comes for the Festival of Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks. We celebrate receiving the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. Shavuot is tonight and tomorrow. You are hereby invited to our Tikkun Leil Shavuot celebration at Congregation Beit Simcha for Jewish study on the subject overcoming trauma and eating lots of cheesecake to do so. It's at 7:30 p.m. at Beit Simcha, 2270 West Ina Road in Tucson. Our closing song is Shema Yisrael, as sung by Sarit Haddad. And don't forget, you can join us at Beit Simcha, not only tonight for Shavuot at 7:30, but this Friday night for services at 6:30 p.m. with an Oneg Shabbat afterwards. Just be sure to email me to confirm, rabbi@beitsimcha, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, beitsimchatucson.org. My friends, Chag Shavuot Sameach. May you have a good Shavuot, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of health and peace.
מתוך הנשמה אדם נופל לפני שהוא שוקע בתפילה קטנה חותכת הדממה שמע ישראל אלוקי
נתת לי את חיי, נתת לי הכל.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.